May I say, first of all, how very happy I am to be back on the airwaves to recount more of my experiences in the exciting world of show business. You may recall that I began the first series by confessing that I'd used a bit of below-the-belt pressure to secure the engagement. I happen to know one or two things about a certain gentleman in the BBC hierarchy. What sort of things, you may ask? Well, he had tried to excuse his gross behaviour at a corporation staff outing as mere boyish high spirits. He was well over 50. But the canteen worker concerned found his overtures altogether too crude for her sensibilities. And when I tell you that she'd spent the previous summer go-go dancing on an oil rig, you will realise that the mark must have been well and truly overstepped. Anyway, the gentleman concerned preferred to let me talk about myself on the radio than talk about him somewhere else. Fortunately, the series proved successful and a second one followed, by overwhelming popular demand. And now here I am sifting through my treasure chest of memories once again. In the coming weeks, these will include accounts of how I was very nearly shot dead by a wife whose marriage I was, nice twist this, trying to save, and how I was abandoned and left penniless by my English employers in far-off Australia, but how, by enlisting the help of the local press, with their great tradition of honesty and fair play for the underdog, I was able to see justice done and leave my oppressors without a leg to stand on. But let me begin now with a story to warm the hearts of all my friends and fans around the world who have a weakness for romance, with a capital R. Not Barbara Cartland's cup of sweet tea, perhaps, but nevertheless a story that proves true love can arrive unexpectedly in the most improbable of disguises. It begins in the dark days of the Blitz. Wartime London was full of foreigners. Just like it is now, I hear you say. Well, yes. But in those far-off days, they were in uniform. Amazing things happened. For instance, there was the American sailor in the West End looking for a good time not far from Piccadilly Circus, a fruitful area. He turned into an alley and walked through an open door. Already well over the limit, he didn't notice the sign which said stage door. He was, in fact, at the artist's entrance to the Piccadilly Theatre, where John Gielgud and a distinguished cast were performing Shakespeare's gory Scotch play. Some members of my profession consider it unlucky to mention the title. But this GI, the stage doorkeeper, had temporarily deserted his post. Not unusual once the actors have checked in and the curtain has gone up. The sailor walked unsteadily through the double doors, down steps and through another door. It was very dark. He groped his way towards a chink of light. By now he was actually on the stage. He stopped as though poleaxed. There, in the green floodlight, were three horrible-looking ghouls prancing round a bubbling cauldron over a fire. They were chanting something he didn't understand, but he sensed it was malevolent. So he turned, ran out into the street, and didn't stop until he got to the Marble Arch. Fortunately, his appearance on the stage didn't disrupt the play. The set was too dark for most of the audience to see him, and those that did very likely put the appearance of a United States sailor on the blasted heath down to a clever topical touch on the part of the director. At about the same time, mid-42, a light comedy opened to rave reviews. It was called... Well, that doesn't matter. All you need to know is that it starred Elaine Kulua. If I used her real name, it might cause embarrassment, even after all this time. She was a delightful French actress brought over here by C.B. Cochran. I happened to be at the first night because I had a contact at the box office. Ivy, the box office manageress. I was bowled over by Elaine Kulua and became an ardent fan. I raved about her to Ivy, who did not respond well, and I sensed that her artistic judgment was clouded by a growing personal interest in the young and promising J. Kingston Platt. I managed to nip this interest in the bud, but not before she'd got me a job fire-watching at the theatre. It was a handy fill-in while I was marking time professionally. Overnight, Elaine Kulua became the toast of London. She fell in love with the place and settled here, married a wealthy industrialist. No one quite knew why. He had very little to recommend him as a husband except money, and Elaine didn't need that. His name, also changed for the purpose of this account, was, well, what can I call him? Fatso will do as well as anything. He had inherited an ailing furnishing fabric business before the war, and then, in 1938, he shrewdly converted the factory to making khaki for army uniforms. Later on, his patriotism and contributions to charity were rewarded with a knighthood. But in 1942, he was dashing all over the world to neutral countries at the expense of the government, and was rumoured to be unfaithful to his wife Elaine in every capital he visited. The marriage was not going well. When he was in London, they had an arrangement that he would call at the theatre every night after the show and take her out to supper. But more often than not, he failed to turn up. Poor Elaine was perhaps not so much in love with him as she was with the idea of marriage, a home and family. His frequent absences upset her greatly. Not that anyone ever heard her complain, and she was 100% faithful, never any hint of scandal in spite of what must have been plenty of temptation, beautiful and successful as she was. Everyone she worked with adored her. She did more for Anglo-French relations than General de Gaulle and Maurice Chevalier combined. Had she remained on the London stage, she might well have compensated single-handed for the appalling damage done to the Entente Cordiale by Charles Aznavour. So, it's 1942. I am fire-watching at the theatre I have not named. The stage doorkeeper is one Neville Palmerston, a man I never liked. The job is one that appeals to the old and infirm, or the bone idle. Neville was in the latter category. Apart from collecting a salary and tips from all the actors, Neville was working a very remunerative extracurricular racket. It was like this. Elaine's dressing room had been specially decorated for her when the play opened. It had a shower, full toilet facilities, telephone, a huge bed with curtains round it in an alcove at one end. Neville, always with an eye to the main chance, realised that this highly desirable room was only occupied 3 hours a night and 2 afternoons a week on matinee days, and didn't make economic sense. So he made an arrangement with Denise Moncrief, that nice Mrs. Moncrief as she was known in Weybridge, and just Denise as she was known at her various places of work in the West End. Denise was, in plain words, a high-class tart. She had a son at a fashionable prep school, and she didn't apply for hire as her colleagues did in Curzon Street and Shepherd Market. She was only available through a third party, which, even after all these years, it would be suicide for me to name. And so, 2 or 3 times a week, sometimes more, Neville would allow her to take a client, or meet a client, in the dressing room occupied only an hour previously by Elaine Couleur. I believe Denise was quite generous to Neville, who, after all, took a certain amount of risk. But, on the other hand, apart from cleaning the place up afterwards, he had nothing to do. I was the only other person who knew about this arrangement, apart from Denise's high echelon clients, and they always left too happy to even think of making trouble. Denise was an expert at relieving the tension that often built up in wartime London, particularly with Americans. She could probably have doubled or even tripled her income if she'd gone in for the speedy services favoured by her get-rich-quick sisters. But she was a dedicated pro. This particular evening, I was sitting in the stage doorkeeper's little cubbyhole listening to Ack Ack Beer Beer on the radio, with Neville puffing at his evil-smelling pipe. The play had ended and the cast had all gone home, except Elaine, who was still waiting for her unreliable spouse. I remember Neville looking at his watch. "All artists must vacate the dressing room 30 minutes after curtain down," he quoted from a faded notice hanging on the wall. "Not Elaine," I said. "She is a star. You can't lay down the law to a star. And anyway, she's probably very upset because that no-good husband has let her down again. You have to try and be human, Neville." He was unmoved. He merely repeated what he'd just said. Denise had booked the room from midnight. There were 20 minutes to go. Just then, there was a buzz on the intercom and a little red disc started swinging in the box over his head, indicating dressing room 1. Thank goodness, said Neville. She's going home. She'll want me to get her a taxi. Shall I go and see? I volunteered. Neville thanked me, too lethargic to move. I must admit, I didn't make the offer to save Neville's energy. To be perfectly honest, I was under Elaine's spell. I was, remember, in my early 20s. I tapped on her door and went in. There she was, in a very glamorous silk robe with feathery trimmings. She was powdering her nose, but I could see she'd been crying. I averted my gaze and asked if she wanted a taxi. "Where is Neville?" she asked. Her delicious accent made Neville sound like an interesting name. I said he was very busy for a moment. "Busy," she said, "that man is always busy doing nothing." And she gave me a dazzling smile. I thought at the time that there was nothing I would not have done for that lovely woman. "What is that lousy profiteering husband thinking about that he's not here?" I said to myself. Then she spoke to me very calmly, with no trace of the anxiety about her marriage which I knew she must be feeling. She told me she'd decided to stay the night at the theatre. She was not going home. Her housekeeper was away and her husband had been delayed in Lisbon. She just couldn't face an empty house. She asked me to tell Neville. "He can lock up," she said. "I should be quite happy alone." I reassured her. "I shall be here all night, miss. I'm fire-watching, but we don't expect any raids. It's full moon." When I told Neville, he was quite put out.
"What am I going to tell Denise?" he said. "She made a firm booking."
Good old Neville, I thought, never thinks of anyone but himself. He stood up and announced that he was going to go and tell Elaine that it was against all regulations, and against the law as well.
"The theatre must not be used for residential purposes, and everyone has to vacate their dressing rooms, etc., etc."
This triggered me into raising my voice, and I told him straight that if he insisted on upholding the letter of the law, then I, personally, would blow the gaff on the private arrangement he had with Denise. I used the phrase, "running a disorderly house." He was visibly shaken.
"Right," he said, "if that is your attitude..."
"It is.
If that is your attitude, then you, Mr. J.K. Platt, had better start looking for another fire-watching job as of tomorrow."
I told him I didn't care. I didn't care very much, as a matter of fact. I was merely filling in, as I said earlier, and was only doing the job while I waited for a call from ENSA, the Entertainment National Service Association. I'd every reason to hope that I was going to play the Noel Coward part in Private Lives, in Cairo. Neville fumed. He swore. I knew I was behaving like a lovesick adolescent, well, in my early 20s, as I said, but I didn't budge. Neville made an obscenely derisive remark about ENSA and picked up the phone. Denise wasn't at her Mayfair number, so he told her maid that number one dressing room was not available for her mistress. He would explain later. Then he stormed off home, muttering vague threats about how he would see to it that, well, in today's parlance, I would never have lunch in this town again. I sat down in his cocoon-like armchair and picked up one of his smelly newspapers from the piles that surrounded it. After a few seconds, the buzzer went and the red disc jiggled over number one. Off I went. Elaine was looking better, and I noticed she'd poured herself a gin and tonic from the well-stocked little bar. She said she was hungry. Could I possibly nip over to the Savoy and get her some food? "Of course, Miss Elaine," I said. "Anything in particular?"
"Well, Jacot," she said. The accent always thrills me. "Jacot. Well, Jacot, if they have a nice piece of fish, halibut or something like that, and half a bottle of Chablis, perhaps..."
I said I'd go and see what they could rustle up.
"Ask for Mario," she said. "He knows me. He's a darling. He will do his best."
So, leaving the stage door unattended, I hurried down the road to the Savoy and sorted out Mario in the grill. He was just about to shut up shop for the night, but at the mention of Elaine's name, he beamed. "Please," he said, offering me a chair and a glass of the Beaujolais Village he'd been sharing with a colleague. Without giving me a chance to say what Elaine wanted, he hurried away. Within minutes, he reappeared with a tray. He'd found a lovely piece of cold salmon and some cucumber and watercress salad. Fish wasn't rationed in those far-off days, too difficult to keep track of, and a few warm rolls and two beautiful hothouse peaches, and not the half-bottle of Chablis she'd requested, but a whole bottle of champagne. Bollinger at that. "With the compliments of the Savoy," he said, popping a carnation into the tiny vase on the tray and throwing a napkin over the lot. "Wish the lovely lady bon appetit." I hurried back. When I opened the stage door, I paused. I sniffed the unmistakable aroma of a Havana cigar, unobtainable in London at that time. I thought. Fatso must be back. My feelings were mixed. I was both happy for Elaine and furious that I now had no chance at all of possibly accepting a glass of her champagne for the trouble I'd been to. I went to her door and gave a gentle tap. I heard whispering. Then her enchanting laugh, the laugh that had captivated a whole generation of theatre-goers. I tapped again, and she called out, "Thank you so much, Jaco. Put the tray down by the door. Thank you." I did so, and then went back to Neville's chair. I brooded for a short while about the injustices of life, and then the unaccustomed glass of Beaujolais had its effect, and I dozed off. It must have been several hours later, because it was just beginning to get light. I woke up with a start. At first I thought I was being robbed. I opened my eyes, and there, a foot away, was the face of a middle-aged man, bronzed, with a military moustache. He wasn't robbing me. He was slipping a £10 note into my breast pocket, one of those crispy white ones that were unaccountably discontinued after the war. I just had time to take in his American Army uniform and the row of ribbons on the immaculate tunic. He gave me a wink and put his finger to his lips. I took the note out of my pocket to make sure it was real, and when I looked up, he was gone. I hadn't even murmured a word of thanks. I just couldn't make it out. My brain started racing, and there was no chance of going back to sleep. Who could this have been? It was obviously not the husband of the lovely Elaine, and she was a paragon of virtue, so there could be no question of a liaison with an American officer, handsome and high-ranking though he undoubtedly was. I was still speculating on what had happened when Elaine emerged from her room dressed for going home. She wore a floppy hat and a mink-lined raincoat which shouted Paris. She looked radiant. She thanked me for getting the supper. "And please thank darling Mario when you see him, Jaco." As if I was often dropping into the Savoy Grill for the odd snack, I asked her if she'd like me to get her a taxi. She declined. "No, thank you so much, Jaco. It's a lovely morning, and London is so beautiful when the sun is shining. I will walk at least part of the way." And off she went. What a woman! Even the tapping of her heels on the pavement excited me. Now, so far, I've told you everything I observed at first hand. You may feel cheated that I can't give you a blow-by-blow account of what went on behind the closed door of dressing room number one, between the lovely actress and the dashing American colonel. I'm afraid you'll have to fill in the details yourself, but to help you, I'll give you my version of what might have happened. This will be based on purely circumstantial evidence, some of which I shall withhold until later. When I do, I shall be surprised if you don't agree that my version is highly plausible. Elaine was, you remember, melancholy. Lonely, let down by her husband for the umpteenth time, she just couldn't face going home to her empty flat in Eaton Square. Oh yes, you can be just as lonely in a luxury flat in Eaton Square as you can anywhere else. I expect Benny Green could quote a lyric on the subject. So she decides to stay at the theatre. She sends out for a meal. She enjoys her gin and tonic. There's a tap at her door. Enter the handsome American, an officer and a gentleman. She could be forgiven if she thought at first it was Douglas Fairbanks Jr. He is sophisticated. He's also confident. He believes, with good reason, that he is in for a fun evening. And when he sees Elaine, her big blue eyes, her ready smile, sitting on the chaise longue in the fetching peignoir, well, he can hardly believe his good luck. But he's too sensitive a man to hurry things along. He takes his time, savouring every moment. They talk, they laugh. They have a lot in common, these two. They may even have mutual acquaintances. As if on cue, I arrive with the food and the champagne. They toast each other. She relaxes. Life begins to look better. I must confess, I can't even guess at which precise moment he realizes she is not the lady the anonymous third party had promised him. but the rapport he establishes encourages him to tell Elaine he is there under false pretences. She is mildly shocked, but she begins to enjoy the joke. That must have been when I heard her laugh. Mistaken identity is, after all, the lifeblood of the type of comedy she'd been acting in that very night. Another glass of champagne, and they were sharing her meal for one. They giggle as she improvises plates and cutlery. Fortunately, Mario had been very generous. They finish the Bollinger. She feels very attracted to this man, and jumbled thoughts flash through her mind. What is her husband doing this evening in Lisbon? Why should she worry? She knew he'd not lack company. Why should she not, just this once, throw her chapeau over the moulin? And anyway, the gallant soldier so near to her now was involved in a bloody war. Tomorrow or the next day, his life might be snuffed out. In wartime, the Grim Reaper is a potent aphrodisiac. Could she bring herself to abandon all she'd been told at her mother's knee and at the convent where she'd been educated? She decided she could. And she could because, like every actress who has ever lived, she has always yearned to play the part of a woman of easy virtue. Colonel Derwent, for that was his name, must have seen the signs. He probably squeezed her pretty hand. Having made her decision, she no doubt flung herself into what followed with all the zest and enthusiasm she'd hitherto kept for her roles on the stage. If this were a film, you'd now be treated to a long and tedious sequence of lip-chewing and instant nudity, followed by much thrashing about on the bed with groans and moans on the soundtrack. But I'm giving you my imagined description of what happened 50 years ago, and I am of the period. So I draw a discreet veil, or I fade to black. Anyway, it cannot have differed so very much from what you and I have experienced ourselves in greater or lesser measure. If you've not yet done so, then may I say I hope you will. I can recommend it. A few hours pass, and I'm woken up as I doze in Neville's chair. Elaine is asleep in her room. Colonel Derwent, who must be back with his unit on the south coast by 9 a.m., looks at his watch, kisses the lovely face on the pillow, and tiptoes away to prepare for D-Day. On his way, he gives me a handsome token of appreciation. A little later, Elaine stirs and reaches out for her surprised lover. She looks round, sees the note on our dressing table, reads it, smiles dreamily, touches it with her lips, and puts it into her bag. She decides to walk home. It'll give her time to think, not only about the events of the night, but about her long-term future. How will she tell her husband? Because being the woman she is, she will tell him. How will he respond? It isn't hard to believe that that was the moment when she first contemplated the possibility of divorce. After she'd left, I snapped out of my reverie and made a few phone calls in pursuit of the ENSA job I was hanging on for. I was told the Noel Coward part had been cast, but I was still being considered for the other part. That meant the cigarette holder I'd invested in was a dead loss, unless I could sell it to whoever was going to play the lead. But I felt disappointed. I walked round to the front of house and had a cup of coffee with Ivy at the box office. She was always willing to lend a sympathetic ear, unless you were trying to buy tickets for a hit show, of course, in which case she was immediately corrupted by the absolute power she wielded. I resisted the temptation to tell her about the events of the previous night, though I know she would have relished a good gossip. Why, she even took the phone off the hook to listen to me whinging about ENSA. She insisted on learning every detail of the negotiations, and twice she had to speak sharply to the queue of people outside the box office who were getting a bit restive. Eventually, after another cup of coffee, she said she supposed she'd better let them have a few tickets, and so I went back to the stage door and curled up in Neville's chair. I was feeling a bit short on sleep, and so I didn't wake up until lunchtime, feeling quite peckish. That reminded me that I hadn't collected Elaine's tray or cleared up the room. Normally, this was Neville's job. He liked to do it before the cleaners arrived so they wouldn't guess what had been going on. I was too late. The cleaner had already been in. Only the tray was left. I picked it up and was just going through the door when Neville arrived. He sniffed and looked at the tray. His eyes rested on the cigar butt left by Colonel Derwent. He gave me a sidelong glance.
"Is Madame taken to smoking cigars now, Jacko?"
I had no intention of telling Neville about Elaine's visitor. My gift for instant improvisation didn't let me down.
"Not at all, Neville. It so happened that she invited me to join her in a glass of champagne. We exchanged a few reminiscences, and she offered me a cigar from the box she keeps in case her husband drops in."
I could see that my smooth lies were really getting under Neville's skin. I began to enjoy myself.
"I suppose I stayed there no more than, a couple of hours?"
Neville glared.
"Never invited me into her room for champagne or anything else. Well, I suppose she recognises me as a fellow artist, and, of course, she's always been very much aware of me as a man."
"Don't talk rubbish," he spluttered. "Anyway, you'd better be on your way. Can't have firewatchers hobnobbing with stars, particularly as you attempted to blackmail me about the business arrangement I had with Denise."
"I'm glad I did. I would have been cheated of a wonderful experience."
"You mean a glass of champagne and a cigar?" I shook my head and gave him an enigmatic smile.
"I mean a whole lot more.
But I don't expect you'd understand. It doesn't happen all that often, but occasionally a man and a woman are together and the chemistry is right. They both throw discretion, convention, loyalty to others to the winds, and surrender to an overpowering urge."
"Get away," said Neville. "You're talking rubbish."
I could see his mind was in a turmoil. He didn't want to believe my far-fetched lie about my night of romance, but he couldn't extinguish the lingering doubt. He snorted and opened his evening paper. "And now occurred a beautifully timed coincidence. There, on the front page, was the headline, 'French Star to Divorce, Elaine Couleur and Millionaire to Part.' Underneath was a picture of the lovely Elaine looking winsome, but, as always, toothsome, in the flower-filled lounge of her flat. I couldn't resist the opportunity this gave me. 'Poor darling,' I said. 'I never meant her to take it quite so seriously. To me, it was merely a brief encounter between two people who met at crossroads in their lives.' I peered closer at the picture. Glad my roses arrived all right. Cheerio, Neville. And with that, I walked away from that particular theatre forever. A year or so later, when I'd returned to London, not from North Africa, the ENSA season in Cairo had been diverted to anti-aircraft sites round Coventry. I was fascinated to learn that Elaine had actually married Colonel Derwent and gone to live in New England. She never acted again, preferring to leave the business at the very peak of her career and to concentrate on being a model wife and mother. So far as I know, she lives there happily still. And now, as these shadows lengthen, it gives me much pleasure to know that I played the role of Cupid, unwittingly but very successfully. Almost as much pleasure as to know that for the rest of his life, Neville Palmerston was plagued by doubt about exactly what did happen that night in dressing room number 1.